Comrades, we finished last time with the aftermath of the Kornilov coup and the beginnings of the real surge towards the Bolshevik Party. I mean to go back. This thing is not very. I mean to go back to. To recapitulate briefly, let us remember. February Revolution put into power, into effective power, in the Soviets, Soviets springing up everywhere, people who believed that not only was the revolution a bourgeois revolution, but that it was necessary for the Soviets to support, to promote a purely bourgeois government. Right? Well, February. Second, in April, June, July, not everywhere, but in some of the major industrial centres, and in particular in Petrograd, there was a growing hostility amongst broad layers of workers, including very large numbers who had not previously been involved in any kind of political activity at all, against this bourgeois provisional government. Remember, the Mensheviks, social revolutionaries, were not actually in the government. We had the situation of the so-called dual power. On the one hand, here we have the ministers, headed by Prince Lvov, wealthy landowner with substantial interest in the Swedish Ericsson engineering firm and all the rest of it, landowner and capitalist. He is the head of the provisional revolutionary government, and the others, in varying degrees, the same sort of thing. Then we have the Soviets, particularly the Petrograd Soviet, which has effective power in reality. Why? Because the government's writ does not run unless it is endorsed by the Soviets. Situation of dual power. Such a situation cannot last indefinitely. Might be possible to underestimate the time. We had such a situation in Portugal, which I thought couldn't last more than 6 or 8 months. Actually, it lasted 18 months, so we shouldn't be too dogmatic about it. Nevertheless, it is an inherently unstable situation. Either the bourgeois government is able to really re-establish significant power, make its writ run, re-establish the bourgeois state, or it will be overthrown. Then we have, as I say, the revolt against this whole change, amongst significant layers of militant workers, culminating in the July days in Petrograd. Here we have a situation in which the Bolshevik Party found itself in an exceedingly difficult situation. They were, their leadership was, and that means Lenin too, well to the right of the workers who launched the armed demonstrations in July. It is true, the party had called for demonstrations. It had also called for restraint. They found themselves in a situation where the vanguard of the working class in Petrograd, supported by very considerable masses of workers, wanted to dismiss the provisional government, get rid of the provisional government, establish Soviet power, workers' power. Calculation of this, it's true in Petrograd. Trotsky, long afterwards, when he wrote his history, looked back at this time and says, you know, he's probably true. But left wing in the Bolshevik Party, never mind the ultra left outside, said, we could probably have taken power in July with little difficulty in Petrograd. But the state of development in the rest of the country is far behind this. It would be, I'm switching from Trotsky to Lenin. Lenin said, another Paris Commune. Not in its good sense, you know. The workers took power, but in its bad sense. Isolated from the rest of the country, smashed, a bloodbath, the workers' movement set back for 30 years. Then, as a result of the retreat that the Bolsheviks were able, because they did by now have the decisive influence amongst industrial workers in Petrograd, although not yet the decisive influence amongst the masses of the soldiers, because of their influence they were able to curb the demonstrations. The last day nearly got out of hand. They found themselves far to the right. Trotsky says, very significant Australian thing. A London Senator, anarchist group, petty bourgeois anarchists, we call them, were actually able to appeal to our workers, you know, effectively against the party. Alarming symptom. Nevertheless, that retreat was a necessary retreat, but any retreat has to be paid for. And of course, after the July days, the regime, gaining in confidence, support, drawing support from the more backward parts of the country, launched a massive attack against the left. Not the sort of attack that Neil Kinnock is leading, because he doesn't want to stay in power. And even if he did, circumstances would not enable him to do it. No, no. The whole argument, the Bolsheviks are German agents. Lenin is a German agent. Lenin is a criminal. Lenin had to flee to go into hiding. Not because he was afraid of being arrested, they had a discussion about it. But because they seriously calculated, actually they will murder us. Trotsky was arrested, that himself would be arrested, and he wasn't murdered, but it was a touch and go thing. All the forces of reaction who had kept their heads down in March, April, and onwards, right through to July, come up again, appear. You see, they haven't disappeared, the middle classes are still there, the forces of reaction are still there. They were on the defensive, keeping their heads down, pretending to be members of the Social Revolutionary Party, actually in many cases actually taking out party cards. When it looked as though the revolution was on the ascendancy, the most of the great slander, German agents, Bolsheviks persecuted, arrested, some murdered, and so on and so forth, which weakened the position of the party in Petrograd. Weakened it but didn't destroy it. Didn't destroy it because at the end of the day, the real base of the Bolshevik Party lay in the factories, and in particular amongst the metal workers, the most important industry in Petrograd. There the terror was not possible. Nevertheless, this enormous reaction drastically reduced the influence of the party. After all, Trotsky was its most prominent spokesman in the Petrograd Soviet. In prison, others, either in hiding, gone to Finland, as Lenin was forced to do, or completely isolated. Problem, ISL. The dual power is an inherently unstable situation. On the one hand, who was leading this witch hunt against the Bolsheviks? Basically, the leaders of the Mensheviks and SRs who controlled the majority in the Soviet. The provisional government itself actually, of course, it whipped on the campaign, but it did not run. It was literally the case that the leaders of the two supposed socialist parties enabled a fiction of a bourgeois government to be maintained. This could not be maintained for very long, as a matter of fact. In this period, I don't want to go into details, this is meant to be a quick recapitulation, and my God, it's taken quite a lot of time already. The provisional government actually collapsed. Prince Lvov decided to sell his shares and so on and seek refuge in Sweden. Nice piece of Scandinavian country. And the leaders of the Social Revolutionary Party and the Mensheviks were compelled to become ministers. They didn't want to become ministers under this non-entity, Kerensky. Kerensky claimed to be a socialist, so a non-party socialist. I don't know how many comrades here remember the days of the Franks. Being a non-party socialist is a very popular thing. Now, what he really means is actually committed to nothing. He was a provincial lawyer who had had some accidental connection with the working class movement in that before the revolution he had defended a few people accused of political offences. He, this nothing, came to the top. Why? Because he was pushed to the top by the leaders of the Mensheviks and the SRs. You see, remember their fundamental notion, this is a bourgeois revolution. In no case was the working class taken actually, of course, they had argued, in no case should we enter the government. We must remain a opposition party, pushing the bourgeoisie forward. In fact, when this broke down in the summer, they did enter the government, but they entered the government on this basis, saying to the principal representatives of Russian capital, politically organized, the Cadet Party, please stay in the government. Please take the prominent post. Please, you know, it's a coalition. In other words, they mortgage themselves completely. As a result, the anti-Bolshevik witch hunt went much further than it's ever a measure of its sponsors as intended. Because after all, for the old parish rite, to the generals who are still there in their academics, to the senior bureaucrats and so on, still controlled by the measure. This is intolerable. This is anarchy. We've got to get rid of the lot of them. They too are wrecks, or at the very least they are wrecks. They're soft on the reds and so on. Away with them! And consequently, a military conspiracy was organised. Now, just three things about this conspiracy. First of all, the man who was nominal head, von Imhoff, had just been appointed by Kerensky as commander-in-chief of the Russian army. That is to say, he's not an accidental colonel, an oligarch, or something of this sort. No, no. He was the CNC appointed by the new left-wing provisional revolutionary government. He was Pinochet, not oligarch. Secondly, behind von Imhoff, all the forces of the action rally and elements of the provisional government, including Kerensky, actually privately hoped for his victory. Hoped for his victory, because it would establish, they thought, a military dictatorship, restore order in the army, put an end to land seizures by the peasants, discipline the workers, and above all, get rid of the Bolsheviks. Problem. The leaders of the Soviet, what does their importance come from? You know, the SRs, the Menshevics. Well, actually, it's the contradictory nature of reformist parties. Under a Kornilov, as under Hitler, actually they too are going to go into the concentration camps if they're not murdered. Yes, it's quite true, the Pinochet in Chile, did not simply persecute the left of the working class movement, he persecuted the working class movement, per se. The most right wing, the most conservative elements, the Eddie Hammonds too went into the stadium. No question about it. And therefore, faced with the threat at the end of August, Kornilov's carefully arranged march on Petrograd, units drawn all over the various fronts and so on, elements of the SR Menshevik bloc, leaders of the Soviet, actually began to hesitate. It was on the initiative of their left wing that a military revolutionary committee was established by the Soviet to prevent a right wing coup. This fantastic position. Some of their leading party members and members who adopted the factory secretly in the alliance with Kornilov. On the other hand, on the other side, other members of leading members of the same party in the Soviet State Military Revolutionary Committee, and this means a deal with the Bolsheviks. Because the Bolsheviks quite rightly said, yes, united front, Kornilov is the main enemy. Not that we support Kerensky, we do not support Kerensky, Lenin said quite explicitly. But we find ourselves fighting on the same side against Kornilov. Therefore, you, the leaders of the Soviet, and the provisional governments there say have little authority, must arm the workers. Reluctantly, and as Kornilov's troops got nearer and nearer, grudgingly, as half-heartedly as they could, they started to do it. That is the origin of the Red Guards. Once the process had been started, however, it proved very difficult to hold. Because by and large, the Petrograd garrison, dominated by SR thinking, quite politically backward, nevertheless could not stomach Kornilov. And they actually had large quantities of arms. And consequently, an irreversible process was set in motion. Irreversible on one condition, that Kornilov be defeated. And it is an indication of the depth of the revolutionary crisis that Kornilov was defeated without fighting. You know, I started out, a long time ago it seems now, with the proposition that the central characteristic of any real revolution is that masses and millions who normally are passive, normally haven't got two political ideas to rub together except to repeat what the sun says or something they've heard somewhere or other, are thrown into activity for the first time in their lives. And this transformed the situation. Because amongst those transformed were the soldiers, and Kornilov were reluctant. When it came to the point, they would not fight. They were Bolsheviks. They were mostly under SR influence. What did they do? They were peasants. They were also peasant conscripts. They agreed, actually, with the Bolshevik slogans. Peace, land, these seem very good ideas, especially peace. right? Out of the war, out of the army, especially the land. And when it came to it, Corlino's forces melted away. Does that mean that the challenge was not a serious one? Very far from it. They would not have melted away, but for the massive opposition, military as well as political, which depended at its heart on the Bolshevik agitation in Petrograd, which was the objective, the capital. Without being faced with a resolute front, without knowing it's going to be house by house and street by street and a lot of us are going to die, without the conviction of that, the other pressure, the weight of the officers, the whole weight of discipline directed against the individual would probably have been effective. But then, when it comes to resolute resistance, and delegates sent from Petrograd regiments, regiments in the garrison saying, don't fight, don't shoot your brothers, and so forth, Kornilov's army, which on paper looked very impressive, on paper should have been able to walk through Petrograd, not walk through, it would have been a slaughter, but you know, and the outcome could not have been down, disintegrated. And now we come to the political consequences. After the retreat in July, ordered by the Guardian, very reluctantly, it had to be done, there had been this massive swing to the right, even in Petrograd. After the attempted coup and its failure, and particularly as the complicity, the connivance of various ministers with Kornilov became obvious not to Bolshevik leaders and highly sophisticated peasants, but obvious politicians, but obvious to peasant soldiers. Then there was a massive swing to the left. The Bolshevik Party experienced a vast influx of actual members. And more important even than the vast influx of members, for the first time, its slogans could get majority votes in the major Soviets. What did they do in these circumstances? What's the argument? Right, holster power. So on and so forth. No. They reverted, and the Lenin surgeons, absolutely rightly, to the argument they had put in March, and were still putting in April and in July, which had, of course, dropped out of the forefront in the period when they were being persecuted by the leaders of the Petrograd Soviet. No, they said, let the leaders of the Soviet majority parties take power. Down with the 10 capitalist ministers, down with the provisional government, for a government based on workers' and soldiers' councils, knowing that we are in a minority. You know, they were quite explicit. We know we will be in a minority. We promise loyal opposition. We undertake not to resort to force against such a government, even though we disagree with it in a whole number of respects. What was the calculation? Again, the calculation is, you know, we know what these scoundrels will do. That's a familiar argument. It is peculiarly important, though, in a revolutionary situation where there are rapid shifts and changes in the consciousness of masses of people. It had to be demonstrated yet again that the very last thing that the leaders of the SRs and the Mensheviks wanted was to achieve power. They clung to the liberals, to the cadets and so on, precisely because they always used the argument, we agree, land for the peasants, it's in the Socialist Revolutionary Party's programme. But comrades, we can't do it yet. We have to have unity, we have to have these liberals, and unfortunately they're capitalists and landowners, they don't really like this thing. Wait for the Constituent Assembly, which will be called someday and will solve all problems. It had to be argued yet again that this is the central slogan for them to take power. In July, at the height of the agitation, there was probably a majority in Petrograd for this notion. Probably. I mean, it's, you know, impossible to judge in the chaos we were. Lenin thought there was a majority, and he's probably right. In September, Kornilov coup was the end of October. This proposition, not the Bolsheviks to power, not on our programme, them to power on their programme based on Soviets, was massive agitation wars, and the results were sensational. You know, you put forward an idea at one time, sits like a lead balloon. You put forward exactly the same idea at a different time, different circumstances, and it catches the imagination.
very brief meeting. Taking time to go through the details. But August the 31st, the Petrograd Soviet overturned its executive, carried the Bolshevik revolution, right? But the Soviet majority parties must take power, and then when they staged to walk out off the platform, proceeded to fresh elections, which, for the first time, gave the Bolsheviks a majority, and a substantial majority, actually, in the Petrograd Soviet. Did that mean that they were new figures? To some extent, yes. To some extent, the process of re-election, which had always been obstructed, of course, on the SR Bolsheviks, had changed the personnel. But more important than that was that delegates from the regiments, who had previously voted solidly in the SR, now defected, and defected not as individuals, but in large numbers, and voted for the Bolshevik position. 5 days later, the Moscow Soviet went the same way. And then, I've got the wrong notes here, and then, it doesn't matter very much, does it? And then, to the second Kiev, Kazan, the old Tatar capital, Baku, the centre of the oil fields, Bryansk, major engineering centre in the north of Ukraine, Kharkov, major centre of metal manufacturing, the coal and steel industry, coal and iron industry, and a whole number of others. I copied out a great list here. I'm not going to repeat them. Soviets in these places, all of which had been dominated by the SR Menshevik bloc, adopted the Bolshevik position, and in most cases voted out their previous leaderships. Still more significant, on September the 10th, there was a Congress, an all national Congress, of all the Finnish Soviets, all the Soviets in Finland. By an overwhelming majority, even though the Bolsheviks had thought they were right, completely Finland, by an overwhelming majority, the Bolshevik position was taken. And still more significant, 2 days later, the federated, all units, Soviet of the Baltic Fleet, which had a fancy title, held a congress against the leaders of the thing had been trying to stall it for days, for weeks, and so on, held a congress. This one really is reporting, worth reporting in detail. There were 731 delegates. The defenders of the provisional government could obtain precisely 42 votes. The rest went Bolshevik or left SR. Overwhelming the notion, down with the provincial government, down with the capitalist ministers, the Soviets must take power, carried. Now then, a whole series of other things, which we haven't time to go into. Deepening process of radicalisation. And now we have a problem. On the face of it would seem, the tactic has been highly successful. The real base of the people who are still controlled, by the way, the all-Russian executive of the Soviets, elected in March, and no longer in any way representative, are, of course, still supporters of the provisional government, given the Congress that is left away. What do we do? Profound divisions opened up in the Bolshevik Party. The second party crisis of 1970. Lenin had been in Finland, and then living underground in Petrograd, was unable still to appear openly, or so he figured. Nevertheless, wrote a series of indignant letters to the Central Committee, arguing, Central Committee is quite a small body, by the way, theoretically 21. In practice, you never get them all together, but some of them in prison, some of them on the run, and so on and so on. Writing, and his letter of the 14th of September, the most significant one, as before the Bolshevik Party, they decided, we must change our position fundamentally. Remember what our position had been. Pressure on the Soviet majority parties to take power on the basis of their Soviet majority. We must change our position fundamentally. The present task clearly must be preparation for an armed rising in Petrograd and Moscow, the overthrow of the government by force, and the seizure of power. Now, by this time, it was clear that the tensions built into the dual power situation were becoming intolerable. No question about it. The provisional government has lost all authority. On the other hand, the Soviets are shifting rapidly. The most important ones are already have Bolshevik majorities. And even in those where there's not a formal Bolshevik majority, actually you can carry the position of a subsidiary. Therefore, the insurrection.
producing a crisis in the party. First of all, the right wing of the party, Lev, Jambia, Zinovia, and Stalin, took the position the time is not wrong. Now, let me explain as effectively as I can, in other words, try and act as a devil's advocate, what they actually said. And in my words, not theirs, it's better, actually, I'll do it better. First of all, there is a deepening process of radicalisation. You look at what has happened, not over the last months, but over the last weeks. Look at what we have gained. This process is irresistible. By encouraging it, by, you know, essentially continuing the present, by no talk of insurrection, and so on, we will be the immense majority. And in particular, we will win the Constituent Assembly. I'll come back to the Constituent Assembly in a moment. Therefore, Lenin's proposition out, and indeed, on the 16th of September, I think, the Central Committee voted by 9 votes to 1, something like that, not only to reject Lenin's proposition, but to burn his letter in case it fell into the hands of the enemy, none could be used together. It's a fact. No question about it. Lenin persisted. In fact, of course, the majority was itself divided. You see, there were two sorts of people who voted against Lenin's proposition. The one who did vote for it, by the way, was not a full CC member, eh? So you could report, if you want to be formal, that it was unanimously rejected. There were two sorts of people. The right wing, Charlie, Zinoviev, and Thorpe, who argued on and on and on, deepening process, inevitable radicalisation, great masses, well, we heard that before. You know, the whole notion of inevitability, passivity, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, there was a different minority, whose most important members were Trotsky, who was president of the Petrograd Soviet again, Sverdlov, who was the national secretary of the party, and, although he was left resolute, Bukharin, who was the principal leader in Moscow. Their argument was a different one. They said, look, there is no question that the time is right for the insurrection. Why is it right? The perspective of indefinite radicalisation is rubbish. Why is it rubbish? Because the economy is falling to pieces. You know, the revolutionary disorganisation and so on. Because in the most advanced centres, and Trotsky was particularly sharp on this, in Petrograd, it is not true that the best players, the most militant players, are becoming more confident, they are becoming sceptical. He wrote subsequently, what he put in their mind, are the Bolsheviks too just talkers, or will they act? It's true, he argued, that in more backward areas, even now, the thing is going forward. But in the key centres, Moscow, in Petrograd, this is no longer the case. We must act now, or we will miss the time. Good, so far, complete agreement with Lenin. But he argued, a call by the party, which is what Lenin was advocating, purely Bolshevik operation, is a non-starter. Here, Trotsky and Sverdlov had a big advantage over Lenin. Although they were both theoretically under arrest, they were on bail, and it was impossible for the provisional government to touch them in reality. Trotsky now heads what is the effective government in Petrograd. Therefore, they were much closer to events. They were much better able to sense what is the real movement. Lenin was skipping from one apartment to another and so on, wearing his false beard, not his false beard, his wig, he had a wig, shaved off his beard and wore spectacles. Much more realistic in terms of what are the tactical possibilities. The tactical possibilities are very simple. The masses will rise in defense of the Soviet. They will not rise on the call of the party. Now, I am sure they didn't just fish this out of their thumb. There had been a series of conferences, Petrograd, various other places. And the general sense of the better elements in the party, by which I mean the ones who really wanted the revolution and had not got cold feet, was, yes, the time is right, but it won't work on a party call. There was, consequently, at the same time, running in parallel, two issues. One, the dispute with the right wing. I'll deal with this very briefly. I mentioned Zinoviev. Zinoviev was there. No. God, no. a whole band of senior party people and old Bolsheviks brought up under the democratic dictatorship theory actually were opposed to the insurrection. There are two kinds of opposition. There's the ones, the honest ones, Charlie Hepp is always honest, saying, I'm a guinea. And then there's the other kind, which you find in any organisation, oh yes, there's a lot in what you say, but I don't know, the time is not right, etc., etc. And the combined weight of these was very, very considerable. Stan Kamenev was in office, played into Lenin's hands. On the 10th, I guess.
No, it must have been earlier. It must have been the 8th of October. They published an article in a non-party paper in which they denounced any notion of an insurrection.
In terms which made it absolutely clear that that was precisely what they thought the Bolshevik party was heading for. Lenin was furious, he denounced the strike raiders. He demanded their expulsion from the party. And now we come to a very interesting fact, contrary to the later myths. Kamenev and Zinoviev offered to resign, right? From the Central Committee, not from the party. Their resignation was accepted at the Crucial CC meeting by 5-3, the 8 people there. They voted for their resignation. That is to say, the rest of the Central Committee or the Comrades Action Operative were equally divided as to whether we should even accept the resignation. After expulsion, that was unanimously rejected. Now, that is after what Lenin called strike breaking. Why? Why? Because the deep heritage of the whole democratic dictatorship theory, the fact people have accepted Lenin's thesis, yes, in principle, but in reality, they could not conceive of the overturn. Thus, the natural conservatism that always occurs whenever a sharp turn is necessary, and my God, don't be so, we're going to try an insurrection and claims will all be shot, which is the reality. If we fail, it will be a super cornelo. 10th, Lenin got his majority. It was the first meeting in the assembly, and incidentally, I mean, it's a title, but it was held at name Menshevik Light. Wow, owned by a well known Menshevik journalist called Sukarnov, whose wife, although Sukarnov did not know this, was a Menshevik with a Bolshevik sympathiser, and later became a member. Why meet in such an odd place? Because still, the provisional government had no authority on all the masses, it still controlled some forces in Petrograd. And it was seriously thought that an open meeting with Lenin present might result in shooting, death of Lenin, and all the rest of it. So they met under these rather comic circumstances for 10 hours. 10 hours! And refreshed Trotsky said by beer and sausages. And it was at that meeting that the decision in principle for the insurrection was taken. It was also at that meeting there was a long, sharp, and inconclusive argument between Lenin and Trotsky. It is not true that Lenin was, you know, the point had been put to him, clicked, yes, agreed, he didn't agree. Only some days later did the penny drop. And the penny dropped because, you know, we have the picture of the Bolshevik party as this monolithic, homogeneous, cuneiform block. It's all absolute rubbish. The penny dropped because Trotsky used his position as president of the Petrograd Soviet, and Trotsky is an individual, this wing of the party, to re-establish the Military Revolutionary Committee. Do you remember the Military Revolutionary Committee? It's been established on the initiative of left-wing Mensheviks in the Soviet, and of course energetically supported by the Bolsheviks, had faded away after Korninov had disappeared. They re-established it. To do what? Trotsky's argument, they have to appear defensive. To defend the Soviets against the working class, the soldiers and so on, against the conspiracies of Kerensky, who is a, you know, his Cornelia, Lovite friends and so on and so forth. The objective was defensive. Because on that basis, it was possible to carry overwhelming support. Now, this overwhelming support, first of all, is important to us, much more important still. There are 150,000 soldiers in and around Petrograd in four. Their support in practice could be guaranteed on such a proposition, on the support of the overwhelming majority. And of course it was not dishonest, because at the end of the day, the dual power, increasingly unstable, cannot persist. There must be another attempt from the right if the left falters. The tide starts to turn, no question about it.
In fact, they were hoping for a provocation. And they were lucky. They got it. What they did, must say, 3 days before the incident, no, 5 days before the October 25th, before the incident, they said, in future, none of the military orders of the government's commanders will be obeyed unless they are countersigned by an authorised representative of the Military Revolutionary Committee. Now that's a direct challenge. It was meant to be a direct challenge, and a provocative one to the government. You can't give orders to your own soldiers without our countersignature. They knew they could carry it. Trotsky's calculation was that they could carry it. They did. Seems to be the death. It was in this period that Lenin shifted his position. He could now operate more or less freely, recognizing it and shifting it. All the time he had been the driving force, from the middle of September, from the need to switch from the previous line of, you know, put the Labourites, if you like, in power, and in this situation they will prove disastrous, we will gain massively out of it. Switch that line from overthrow them by force. By force, because remember, this government by now, although it still had its capitalist ministers, was headed by a nominal socialist Kerensky, and included the representatives in various ministerial posts of the what had been the Soviet majority party. Many had been the driving force. Tactically, however, his prescriptions were not good. He also wanted to start the insurrection in Moscow rather than in Leningrad, because on his information he thought things were more advanced in Moscow. Eventually, the show was entirely wrong. I mentioned this thing in Moscow because I don't want to. I pointed out the essential role of Lenin at various stages to promote the notion that the man was in some way infallible. Nothing of the kind. Nothing of the kind. He made a mistake which would, if it had been pushed through, have proved probably disastrous. The important thing, he was able to correct it once he saw the reality. Good. The provisional government eventually screwed up its courage, summoning yet again, for the third time, what they hoped were revival units from the Northwest Front and elsewhere, set a date, the 24th of October, on which they would smash the Military Revolutionary Committee and the Petrograd Soviet. They thought their troops were coming in. They weren't in any great numbers. Right, they weren't in any great numbers. There is a very amusing story in John Reed's book about two supposedly reliable regiments summoned back from near Riga, no doubt delighted to get away from the front, until they discovered that they were being sent to Petrograd. So they stopped and insisted on sending a telegram. To whom? To the military commander in Petrograd. Nonsense. To the Petrograd Soviets, saying, we are being ordered to Petrograd. We do not understand this. What should we do? Go right back to the Military Revolutionary Committee. Wait! Stay where you are! We'll send a deputation, we'll discuss it with you. And this was multiplied many, many times. What, sir, the government did have, however, was a number of units that had been able to bring in one infantry formation which it thought it could rely on, but which is eventually proved it could not at the end of the day, at least in opening reasoning. The officer cadet schools, and they drew in people from a very wide area, not simply from Petrograd. They even had a volunteer company from the women's battalion and various things, new armoured car units. They had a force which obviously is enough if it's confronted with the weight of the Petrograd garrison, but which, if it is confronted with relatively small forces, actually quite sufficient to inflict substantial damage. On the basis of this, they issued arrest warrants for all the members of the Military Revolutionary Committee. Trotsky was its president too. He had a number of hats on this period. Another order, suppressing the Bolshevik press, the entire Bolshevik press, and they interpreted it very literally too. They even took Maxim Gorky's paper, the one that Kanyev had written to, which was against the insurrection, never mind that, friends. Suppress the law, you know, and so on. They made plans, although they were still hesitating on the night of the 24th whether to do it, to elect, to arrest the executive of the Soviet itself, the majority of whom were now. Well, which way, whether they would have summoned up courage or not, we don't know. Because, of course, this was precisely the provocation that was required. Trotsky, tactically, absolutely faulty for this period, realized it. As soon as the orders for arrest were out, the agitators were out. No orders to be obeyed. not simply no orders to be obeyed, though. Here are the plans of the Military Revolutionary Committee, which the units, the military units, Red Guard and the regiment, conscripted absolutely accepted. And they were worked out with great detail and great precision. Trotsky himself said later, an experienced staff officer might find faults with these things, but they served their purpose. What were these things? They were that at 2 o'clock in the morning, that is to say, this is the 24th and the 25th, military parties, wherever possible, with a contingent of armed workers or sailors with them, will occupy all railway stations, all power stations, communications dumps, ammunition dumps, supply dumps, depots, telephone exchanges, the state banks, and every big printing works. Every big printing works was important. Remember, the press was going to be suppressed by the women. They already had the main radio station, because it was a naval station. I haven't time to go into that, I'll skip it. They already had it! And then, right, in fact, having taken over in the small hours of the morning, before dawn, they then moved out to those centres of resistance, with one exception, where the provisional government still had forces. By 10 o'clock, the Military Revolutionary Committee, 10 in the morning, the 24-hour clock ability to obviously simplify things. By 10 o'clock in the morning, they were able to announce the provisional government has been overthrown. There is no resistance in Petrograd. There have been no casualties. Now, the last two statements were not entirely true, but they were true in substance. There was one centre of resistance still. The Winter Palace was still held by a small number of units which not only the Provisional Government but also the Military Revolutionary Committee thought would obey orders. And therefore the attack on it had been delayed and delayed and delayed precisely because they wanted no casualties or no significant casualties. You know, I heard Pepper yesterday in the debate talk about a peaceful revolution. Actually, there has never been anywhere in the world, and it is impossible to conceive there being a more peaceful revolution in that sense than October in Petrograd. With these exceptions, I said it's also true there were no casualties. There were casualties, but our only recorded casualties are due to accidents. People who are not used to firearms and so on sometimes shoot themselves in the foot. There were no casualties actually caused by enemy action. You know, before the thing, Lenin had argued, you know, he still argued with the majority, didn't want that. The regime now is as rotten as the Tsarist regime was on the eve of the 5 days. You know? Underestimated its degree of rottenness. After all, the 5 days involved serious fighting and a lot of casualties. The Kerensky regime went down without a shot, really, except for the Winter Palace. The Winter Palace was not actually taken until late in the evening. And it was taken not after a bloody struggle, although there was a lot of shooting. Both sides, you know, the Red Guard units, the regular units from the garrison had surrounded it. The officer cadets and so on were blasting away. They had lots of ammunition and they were using it as an experienced soldier doing on a really massive scale. Very few casualties, and they weren't really ready for serious fight. Because when, by preparation, and after a lot of hesitation, as a matter of fact, it's not true at all that the Military Revolutionary Committee was so bloody bold and resolute. They had a lot of disagreements as to whether to do it or not. They had the cruiser, right, within range. They fired, first of all, 3 blank rounds at the Winter Palace. You know, in order to convince the garrison, you know, we can reduce this to a heap of rubble. The garrison still didn't surrender. It was necessary to fire live ammunition. But there was no real assault. Contrary to that marvellous film, you know, what's it called, Lenin in October, spectacular Russian propaganda film. I mean, it's lovely stuff, and it's historically inaccurate. The truth of the matter is, the garrison melted away, did not seriously fight. And then, Winter Palace, Kerensky had disappeared, left for the front. And now we come to nearly final, I won't keep you in touch, but very important thing. Remember, all this had been done, not in the name of the Bolshevik Party, but in the name of the Petrograd Soviet.
should have told you before that for the end of October, at long last, there was to be a second national congress of all Russian Congress of Soviets. Such a thing had been called for much earlier, but it had been blocked by the Menshevik and SR leadership, because of course they knew that they were shooting against them. They were afraid to call a congress, very afraid to have a vote. But with the Bolsheviks from the end of August, the beginning of September, getting the majority of more and more important Soviets, it became impossible to maintain this position. So they delayed it until the end of October as long as possible. But delegates were already arrived. By the end of the 25th of October, the provisional government no longer existed. On the following day, the Congress, which admittedly was not wholly representative, that is to say, there were lots of delegates from various places, had not arrived, nevertheless, it was sufficiently representative, assembled. It had a Bolshevik majority, but it had a very, very substantial SR minority, as well as some Mensheviks. Fully representative in that sense of the political bill. This Congress took the following decisions. This is, you know, the culmination of the October Revolution. Three things. First, the provisional government out. As I have practiced, we establish a provisional revolutionary government of people's commissars. All those elected were Bolsheviks. Fine, there isn't much we could do. They didn't fit. But otherwise, we are not, is another question. Secondly, we order the immediate expropriation of the land laws, the lands of the peasants, not after a constituent assembly, not after our surveyors have spent 6 months working out who gets what, but now, fundamentally important, remember, the mass of the population is peasant, and third, absolutely essential, both for the army and the working class, we call on all the warring powers to stop fighting.